committee, I welcome you with open arms.
Is that so? How late do you stay open?
You don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth. You can't handle the truth.
I hope they are watching. They'll see. They'll see and they'll know. And they'll say, well, she wouldn't even harm a fly.
What's up, everybody? You're listening to NoCo Cinema here on WGM Plus. We are your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago. I am Tom Hush.
And I'm Connor Cornelius.
And we are always excited to be back with you for another week of Chicago Film Talk. Connor.
How are you doing?
I was supposed to ask you that.
I was finishing your sentence because we're just so close like that.
Yeah, I mean, we do have a pretty special relationship. Yeah. It's a little bit like Bush and that British guy. Tony Blair.
Christian Bale. Tom, I wanted to ask, when you were making that intro, did you add like an octavizer to the Psycho voice?
No, that's how...
That's how he speaks?
Well, because it's in his mom's voice.
Right, I know, but I was just...
He's not delivering the line. You know, it's not Anthony.
I know, but listening to it, it just sounds like it could be affected at some point. But mm-hmm. I guess that just is a testament to that actor's ability.
Yes.
Anyway,
I can't believe you.
I don't know, man.
An octavizer.
Why not?
I wish I had.
I throw that shit on whenever I record my voice. I throw that shit on it because I'm ashamed of it. But it's a beautiful day here in downtown Chicago. Can't see the lake.
Can't see anything. But that's okay because you're not using your eyes right now.
No,
we're using our ears.
Yes, podcasting is a very visual format, but don't need them today.
I'm in my nice purple robes.
Uh-huh. You look beautiful. It's a Sonic Youth themed like bathrobe with a bunch of holes in it.
Yeah, and just a big picture of Kim on the back. Kim Gordon. My favorite. Well, I feel like we're getting off topic. We've got a great show for you here today. You know, it's been a little while since we've had some filmmakers in the studio, and it's also been a while since we've had an actor. So we decided, why not knock out two birds with one stone?
Why not both?
Why not both? Now, Connor, you happened to meet one of our guests at the Women of the Now showcase.
Yes.
Over at the New 400 Theater, correct?
Yes. Actor Hannah Copen was there attending the showcase, and we got to talking, and she told us about a very exciting project of which she was a part, called Hammersmith, which was part of the 48-hour film festival, which we're going to be talking about a little bit here. And we have actor Hannah Copen in the studio, as well as
classically trained
actor Hannah Copen, and classically trained director, editor, producer Kyle Leland.
Super classically.
Yes. Well, thank you so much, guys, for coming into the studio. We
Thanks
really appreciate
for having
this.
Us.
Yeah, thank you.
This is awesome.
So I guess let's get started with both of your stories as to how you got into your respective places in the film world. Hannah, you're an actor, Northwestern University alum.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. That's right. What got you into acting? What was your first steps into that?
Oh, man. Well, I've always kind of been a storyteller and loved playing imaginative games, and always was just intrigued by what you can create on stage and what you can create in terms of finding different facets of yourself. And ever since I was a little girl, like 4 years old, I think I saw Les Miserables on Broadway, and just... it just wowed me. It floored me. And I learned every single line to Eponine's monologues and songs. And she's the one that dies. And so this like 5-year-old girl was at Thanksgiving basically like entertaining my family with all these dying songs. But I knew like from then, from just performing, I just wanted to do that for the rest of my life. So I kept finding different avenues, whether that's, playing make-believe with my friends, or it was putting on actual plays at school and then creating stories with creators. And I loved collaborating with teams and people, and at Northwestern really got to do that a lot. And then since then, just been following my dreams in film and finding film as my favorite media and medium to create those stories that make an impact and tell really meaningful stories that maybe otherwise wouldn't be told.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, was theater kind of your first... I mean, it sounds like it was.
Definitely first love, yeah.
Were you interested in doing theater over acting, or was like acting on film kind of always your ultimate goal?
both and still both. I still love the theater. There's nothing like getting up in front of a live audience and feeling that energy. I mean, it's definitely a give and take of that audience's attention and what they're giving to you and giving them back something that they can walk away from and think differently about life or about themselves or see themselves on stage. That's something that's really visceral that you get on the stage versus and on camera. I mean, you get unlimited takes, you get to work with an incredible team, you get to work with a crew, really form that tight-knit kind of family. And it's a different art form, but it's very much one and the same in terms of telling that story and really creating that that different perspective for the audience.
It's such a collaborative thing, whether it's film or theater, right?
Yeah, definitely.
So it's a big family. I've never done really either, but I can only imagine that it's just everybody working together in concert to put on something special.
Yeah. It takes a village, for sure.
And speaking of a village,
yeah.
We have another collaborator of yours in the studio, obviously,
the
Kyle
idiot.
Leland. Yeah. The self-described. We're not gonna or unless that was how you would like to be produced or introduced, but yeah. Kyle Leland is the director of the
co-editor and co-writer.
The multi-hyphenate. The multi-hyphenate plus village idiot of the 48-hour film festival submission Hammersmith.
Yes.
So let's talk a little bit about directing, being behind the camera, and it's kind of boilerplate, but what got you into that? What were you watching, or what was that moment when you saw that as a future for yourself?
That's a good question. I think it's my dad had one of those those late 80s, handy cams that he would film home videos in, and we would just grab it and try to film magic tricks with my brothers, like those things where you'd start filming, take something away, start filming again,
The beauty of the cut.
Yes. I early learned the beauty of the cut. But then, I kind of just always knew I wanted to do it. I took a bunch of acting classes and film camps and stuff during grade school and high school. Just got right into it. I actually also have some family. I have a couple uncles who are Teamsters who would take us on sets and stuff when I was a kid. So that probably spurred us on,
The firsthand experience is usually the best.
Yeah.
That's because then you get to see it actualized. It's not just an idea of, oh, wow, wouldn't it be cool to be Steven Spielberg or, one of these guys.
Right.
How did you two meet? How did you come together?
Wow, that's a cool story.
Yeah, actually it was so I worked for a long time as a PA, mm-hmm. and I was working on a TV show called Mob Doctor.
Yeah, the Mob Doctor.
Ooh, I remember that.
It was awarded the least watched show on Fox.
That fully awesome. Played a season. Yeah. Yes. It was a blast. It was a blast cool. behind the scenes, though. It was a lot of fun to work on.
Yeah, it was great. I was I was a featured small extra role, and you were on set.
Yeah, I was kind of like, my job was always in charge of placing the extras and all that stuff, and signing them in and all that stuff. And Hannah got a featured extra role, mm-hmm. so she came in and we kind of met there, and then I think we just kept running into each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, different film events, film screenings. We just kept kind of it's a tight knit community here in Chicago. When you're in the industry, you kind of know a little bit of everybody. You see people's names come up often, and
So both of you got in really at the ground floor. You being a PA, Kyle, and you being a featured extra, doing that kind of small time but important acting work for the larger ideas of television shows or movies, what have you. Tell us a little bit about starting a career down there. What were some of the hardest parts of trying to get into this industry?
Yeah, I mean, it's still tough. You still gotta, I was a PA for literally 10 years, and I still sometimes go back and do some PA jobs. But I got super lucky with my first PA job, and then I kind of just made friends, and then that kind of just, piggybacked from one job to another job. One thing you realize is, the hardest thing was probably, working 70-hour weeks. I was a lazy kid, smoking pot, doing nothing. And then suddenly I'm working 70-hour weeks, getting yelled at, and getting these big-time millionaire producers coffee. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it, yeah, I mean, it's definitely like humbling though, and you kind of you learn how much a film set is like a family, and like you really like like the people that I worked with on a lot of these sets are like just like great friends, you know, and they always will be, you know, because. But yeah, I mean, then after that, you kind of just it's great though just to see how these big productions are done.
Yeah,
and then you have to go and kind of make it at a much smaller scale, but you kind of see how the relationships go and. You know,
is definitely that's one of the things about acting is like it's a job where you're kind of always unemployed until you are employed, and then everything just hits the ground running and you are working like constantly, and you have to wake up at 4 a.m. for a call at 5 a.m. and you know it's 12-hour days or 14-hour days, and then it stops, and then you're looking for another job, and you're interviewing again, and you're auditioning again, and it goes to show like the importance of making relationships with each one of those jobs, because you never know who's going to be crucial or who's going to be on the next job that you might be a part of, and that might know you and that might have a, you know, remember you from something and want to pull you in. And that's kind of how it worked. That the Mob Doctor was the first big, you know, full set, full television series experience that I got at a pretty young age. And that was a really cool experience, pretty eye-opening.
That's kind of the vicious and beautiful cycle of film, right? That's like that is just born out of the format itself, because you require so many people in order to make the product. There's always constantly different, you know, creative minds coming together, constant opportunities that are presenting themselves, right? So so you never,
I mean, that's a phone call on a Wednesday afternoon, be like, hey, listen, we got a feature, we got a role for you, it's small, pays decently well, calls at, you know, 6 a.m. this Friday, do you have time?
Or maybe you're on the least watched show on Fox, The Mob Doctor, as a PA getting the featured extras around, and then you end up making a film in 48 hours and getting to go to Paris.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's pretty fucking cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about the 48-hour film festival.
Yeah. That the format of that is mind blowing. Please. Yeah.
It's awesome. I really liked it. The whole reason I did it was just because like I've been wanting. You know, I had like a bunch of little ideas for short films, but like, you know, actually getting yourself to do it is, you know, tough because it's a lot of work. So the 48-hour film fest is great because it kind of just, it forces you, just as, okay, like here, you know, sign up, and then this day you have to do it, you know? But it's awesome because you basically, so you sign up ahead of time and you can just get some people who are interested. I saw Hannah was interested in like a Facebook event, so I reached out to her and said like, hey, do you want to act in ours? And she was like, yeah.
That's how it happened. You gotta know people in the business in order to make it work. Yeah,
for sure.
But then basically we just showed up, like me and Justin Floco, my longtime collaborator, we basically showed up to this location with all the other teams on like Friday night at 6 p.m. and we literally picked a genre out of a hat, and it said action adventure or mockumentary, so that was our genre. And then they put up on a screen a character name and a prop and a line of dialogue, and then they said, okay, go make a film.
So they gave you the criteria,
right? Yeah. That way you know that it is actually made in that the next 2 days, and like you didn't already rewrite.
I see.
So
it's got to help a little bit, because generating, if you had to generate an idea in 48 hours, just thinking of a genre alone can be like a process, and being like, okay, what do I want to do? Who is the character? What's it going to be about? What's the dialogue going to sound like?
Yeah.
Luckily, they help you along a little bit with that. But I love the idea of...
It can be kind of jarring, though, because some people pull out musical.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh,
yeah. I don't know how to do music.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That'd be kind of funny, though.
But that kind of...
It is.
It's the idea that the... The constraint is the mother of invention,
exactly.
In a sense. You know, the less you have to work with, in terms of like, you know, you don't have every genre to pick from. You have one genre to pick from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that can be really what starts things. And that's what gave us this film Hammersmith.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I mean, it's funny. Most people don't see it that way. They kind of get scared when like, oh, we have to write about this. Blah, blah, blah. But yeah, but it really does do that. It kind of makes your mind start thinking in totally different ways where, this movie...
Guideline.
Yeah. This movie would never have existed if it wasn't for those exact suggestions, you know?
And it's a challenge, right? I mean, the success of the film, which we'll talk about in a second, but it's really just a testament to your guys' ability to adapt, right?
Definitely.
I mean, how would you be able to do that if you guys didn't have something special or worth, you know, other people seeing?
Yeah. Yeah, adaptation mm-hmm. is definitely something you learn quick on film sets nothing ever goes
so
right.
So many quick changes. Yeah, absolutely.
The idea that you have in your head never comes to fruition. It always becomes something completely different.
So tell us about Hammersmith. You know, this is a 48-hour film project. You guys had, 2 days to turn this around. Mm-hmm. How did that happen? How did you manage to get that all together?
So me and Justin Flocco and Eric Miller, we basically took these suggestions and we went straight over to Eric's house and we just started thinking, and then we thought for a few hours and then we freaked out for a couple hours as we didn't know what we were going to do. And then around 3 a.m. is when our actual idea kind of started coming out, and we were like, oh yeah, like, well, oh, that'd be funny. I'm like, oh, okay, we'll call these people. And we didn't actually like secure roles and like contact people until like 3 a.m. is when we were calling, texting actors. Like, okay, like, so tomorrow at noon, like, be here and you're going to be like this type of person, and I'll tell you about it tomorrow. And then basically we showed up at noon and we shot for like 15 hours.
We had to scramble. Yeah. I mean, I scrambled to get a couple locations, and it was a team effort to get all of the spaces.
Yeah,
and
Hannah
all
pulled
the
through the huge location that was awesome.
And they're beautiful, by the way.
Yeah. Well, we got
all of the locations are awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, we got super lucky that like
that apartment,
Justin's sister had just moved out of an apartment. So she had this big open apartment in a really cool area. So we had that to ourselves and we're like, okay, cool, we'll just set it here.
And it was lucky enough to have like a cobblestone courtyard with like vines, swimming up the walls, and it just like had this very cinematic look to it.
Yeah.
And we secured the Cafe Roby for a couple scenes.
And we also cast the Hammersmith, the main role to our old friend Nick Wilson, who is awesome improviser who works in like, he does stuff at CIC and IO, and it's like when you're shooting a movie in 2 days, it's really good to have an improvised actor, who can just kind of make up lines, especially in this interview format that we had going. Mm-hmm. So we ended up finishing his stuff at like 2 or 3 a.m, and then Justin and I went to his house and we just started editing and we didn't sleep. Thanks to Adderall. But we got a bunch of...
We'll see if we can get the rights for that.
How can we get it?
Yeah.
So for everybody listening, can you give us the premise of Hammersmith? What's the film about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically it's... I almost want people to watch it not knowing what it's about because it has a nice little twist at the beginning. But,
okay.
But who cares? So basically it's... it starts out as an action film and then suddenly it stops and you see that it's behind the scene. It's a behind the scenes video mockumentary of this narcissistic director making an action film, and all the things that go wrong because of his, bravado.
It's a little bit of Other Side of the Wind.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was made right around the same time as Disaster Artist. So I think there might have been some influence of that coming up.
Yeah. Yeah. I've even heard from friends and other viewers who've seen it that they've said, did you see A Disaster Artist?
Yeah.
Like, have you seen Room?
Yeah. Yeah, no.
Room?
Or it's called Room, right?
Yeah.
The Room.
Yeah, The Room.
The Room. The Room.
I mean,
Room is very different. Yeah. Very different.
Yes.
Another painful portrait, but of a different type.
So it's basically about this guy, Bayou Straits is a filmmaker who is trying to make this film, and he has a bunch of... crew members who kind of realize how crappily he's doing these things
while they're working with him. So they're still putting on face when they're working with him to make it happen. But they realize.
So the reason we came up with that was because we got action adventure or mockumentary, and we wanted to kiss up to the judges a little bit. So we decided to do both and combine the genres and make a mockumentary about an action adventure. So
I love how you guys touch on kind of some misogyny in filmmakers.
Yeah.
With the it was the director of photography.
Yeah.
When she's saying
he said that to me.
Yeah, what does he say? What does she say?
She says he hired me because he thought that the film would
do better in fests if you had a female director.
A female in a creative role. Yeah.
He said that to me.
He said that to me. Yeah. Yeah, no, it definitely wanted to play on like kind of today's kind of atmosphere of, what's going on in the industry, mm-hmm. and how there's misogyny, and then there's also like misogyny that's like, masked in, making, trying, just like playing it like it's a game,
Right.
And like you know, pretending to be, to not be misogynistic, but really you're just trying to do better for yourself.
And all these great ideas is in 48 hours.
In yeah. 48 hours. Yeah.
And I mean, this was a film that did incredibly well at the 48 Hour Film Fest, correct me, best film.
Yeah.
Audience award, best actor, best director, best writing, best cinematography, best editing. Is so you swept, basically.
Yeah. Pretty much. Yeah. There was one other film that was great, that was really good, that tied with us for writing, mm-hmm. And got best actress, which they totally deserved. It was another great film, but yeah, we did pretty well.
Well, it's a fun idea because it doesn't seem like a competition against others. It's more of a competition against yourself to see if you can do this. And right. and the awards yeah. are great and they're fun, but I think it seems like the real value of what you guys did was in literally just the thing itself, making the thing itself. So
and yeah. finishing it at 5 p.m. on Sunday.
You know? Yeah, Hannah, yeah. So when did you get the message that you are the locations manager and also the lead actress in the film?
Locations manager was like day of.
Yeah.
And luckily I was working at the Hotel Roby at that time, so I kind of just like...
Okay, grease the wheels.
Come on, guys, let's go, let's go, let's go. Yeah. Get in. And then I think the weekend before, Kyle asked me, maybe at 2 a.m, like you said. Yeah. Like, hey, are you available on the 12th between like the hours of this and this, and you know, probably no sleeping? And I said, yeah, sure, I'll do it. Like, let's do it.
Yeah.
Because you got to say yes to these kinds of opportunities. You never know how far they're going to go. You never know what's going to come after it. And it's just so fun. It's like what I live for in Chicago, of being a creator and a collaborator and an artist. You know, it's part of why Chicago is so cool, because there's so many opportunities like this.
Yeah.
I mean, just being a part of this family has led to so many other wonderful things, and that's what you've got to kind of take away from him.
When I met you at the Women of the Now showcase, mm-hmm. you said, I think this film was selected for Cannes, or is it Cannes? Is it Cannes? I'm sorry.
I'm going to put
Cannes.
Cannes.
It's Ken.
Ken.
It's like
Ken.
The doll.
Ken.
Ken.
Kim.
Yeah.
But not, right?
But like you have Frenchier. To pronounce it differently.
But we're in Chicago. We're in Chicago. We say Cannes.
We say Cannes.
I went over Cannes. What it definitely is not. You do not pronounce the S.
Okay. It's not Cannes. No. It's not like Ray Fine.
Rafe.
Right.
Well, that's the opposite. Like, God damn it. This is getting totally out of... But
official 48-hour selection.
So, well, first, before Ken, it was selected to... Because it won Best Film here, it actually went to Filmapalooza in Paris first.
Which is the International 48-Hour Film Fest.
And it has nothing to do with Lollapalooza or Live Nation.
It does not. Correct? No, correct. Yeah. They just kind of, you know...
The Palooza family put it together.
Right. And that was like a miraculous experience, because we were all... There's give or take 10 of us, between 7 and 10 of us staying in this bohemian style 4-person apartment in Paris, France for 10 days. And we were going to Filmapalooza, but we're also shooting episodes 4 and 5 of a 5-part series.
So basically once it won and we were like, oh my God, like people like this movie. Cool. Then we were like, oh, well, we're going to Paris, and all the actors wanted to come. So we're like, okay, well, if we're all going to be in Paris, like, let's just bring a camera and shoot something.
Yeah.
So we decided, I sat down with the other two writers, Eric and Justin. We kind of went through some ideas, and then I kind of just wrote out a full script, and we actually decided to turn the short film into a 5-episode web series. And so we actually went to Paris to shoot episodes 4 and 5. Before we even shot episodes 2 and 3, you know, because like that
George
would be
Lucas
climax.
Method,
yeah,
right. Exactly. Yeah, like how you
it
do
is the
film,
Star Wars
yeah.
of web series. Exactly.
Were you guys able to film at Cannes? Like, what are the rules of Cannes? Are you allowed to film?
Oh,
there?
We didn't shoot at Cannes.
Not at Cannes.
Okay. Just
Cannes. Cannes is in the south of France.
That would have been
a Paris. Yeah.
Okay. That would have been a great place for Bayou Straits.
I know. We thought. Well, yeah. Nick actually couldn't get out there, so we didn't have Bayou Straits. But we kept thinking about like, oh, should we shoot something? But it was kind of just we just wanted to enjoy it, because Filmapalooza weekend we were kind of all over the place.
Yeah, we were running around all the streets of Paris trying to film, and we even brought a drone, I think.
Yeah, which But we did not use that drone, as far as the officials know. We did not use a drone in Paris.
Don't. Okay.
So we will not follow us.
Never confirm nor deny the use of a drone.
Super illegal. Yeah.
We've had a filmmaker on here before talk about Cannes, Elias Rodriguez, and
he's awesome.
He is awesome. Very awesome. And he talked about how he felt as though the 48-hour film fest, or just like the short film section of Cannes, I'm sorry, now I'm just self-conscious.
Yeah, it is.
Is a little cordoned off from the rest of the festival. Was that your guys' experience, or what was your time like at Cannes?
Well, it was just a blast. It's just, the whole town is beautiful, and it's all there for that festival. But it is kind of funny. Well, like the actual, you know, there's only like 10 official selection films, like feature films
that are in the palais, and it's like this huge.
I didn't actually go see one of the major films.
I did,
but Hannah did.
I did with Justin.
Yeah,
we saw Burning.
The other Cannes movies that I just recently saw were Capernaum and Shoplifters,
Young?
And like, which are both amazing. Like the whole
Shoplifters was great,
so good. So yeah, Cannes definitely chooses amazing
and
films.
We were part of the short film corner, which is in a smaller cinema, which has a smaller audience, but we were screened with other short films that were around 6 to 10 minutes long each.
And yeah,
our screening was a. You know, we had a full packed house, which was mm-hmm. wonderful.
Yeah, it is kind of weird because like there's this whole
there's many movie theaters happening at the same time as the other 10 selected films.
So like the main films are on this like huge like arena like theater, but then the other ones, the short films, short film corner itself actually is like a bunch of short movies that most of them don't even get the screen. Ours was lucky enough to be part of like the official 48-hour selection, so it actually screened, mm-hmm. which was awesome. But yeah, it is. There's kind of this whole lower floor thing where there's just like all these different movies. Like, I don't even understand
all
like,
happening
it was,
at once.
Yeah.
And it's a whirlwind. Cannes
is a marketplace.
It's a marketplace. There's multiple tents where people are shopping their future films and their production and their distribution rights.
It's like a palooza itself.
It really is. Yeah. And half. Maybe even more is just meeting people in the industry and talking shop with them and talking about art and what they're doing and who they are. And
as much as it is a you know, an artistic festival where you're seeing some of the best of international cinema, mm-hmm. that's what we've kind of gathered, is that it's mm-hmm. a lot of business.
It's a networking festival as well. Yes.
Yeah.
Definitely.
What kind of people do you meet?
Mostly producers.
Yeah. Were
mostly.
They from all over the world, or were they? Did you find there were a lot from the U.S. or?
There were definitely a lot from the U.S. There were definitely a lot from all over the world that work in L.A. as mm-hmm. well, too. I think, you know, just about everybody spoke English, but you could meet somebody from Berlin and somebody from London, somebody from Portugal, and they're all working to create films together or produce films together or invest in films together. And it's a whirlwind of a place. It's pretty remarkable. So the place in the Palais is there's about 180 feet of red carpet and probably 200 or 400 cameras that are just focused on the outfits that walk down the red carpet. And you get to watch all of that. And that all happens every single day at Cannes for 2 weeks at 6 p.m. And you watch all the stars. You see everybody, you know, posing for the cameras and then walking in to reveal their big premiere. It's kind of a once in a lifetime experience.
So exciting. Well, hopefully it's not once in a lifetime.
No.
I want to see you guys back there. That would be fantastic. I do want to ask, and maybe this is a little bit outside of our purview. I don't know. It's kind of a weird question, but as artists yourselves, I've always been curious about the place that Cannes is filling right now in terms of as a networking event and a place to buy movies, when we're starting to move to a world where that's not necessarily how people are getting picked up anymore. We're seeing a lot more just kind of digital distribution, people going around these more traditional models of film distribution. Instead of meeting a producer, mm-hmm. you're just making sure that your film meets all the technical requirements and putting it on Amazon Prime.
Right.
And we've talked to many filmmakers such as Jason Kaufman with his fantastic House sitters, you know, he put that straight on to
Amazon Prime.
And perhaps it's hard to quantify because, you know, it's a kind of an amorphous thing, but perhaps reaching a larger audience than if he tried to take it to a producer, take it to a film festival where someone might see it. I just want to get your guys' read on that, having been in that world of opulence and traditional film distribution. Yeah.
Well, I think, I mean, even like Netflix and Amazon and all those people, they still have representatives that definitely go to those film festivals. Mm-hmm. So there's always definitely a benefit to bringing it there because you'll find somebody who will actually, you know, sell your film for you. You know, because if you just put it somewhere yourself, you still need, you know, the help of knowing how to get people to watch it.
You gotta know, as Hannah said, you gotta know people
and relationships. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, I wish I knew more about it. I'm still, you know, learning it about it myself. And while it's completely changing into something new, it's a really weird time.
It is. I think it's changing into something new, but I think that there's still a very like high level of respect for those that are still, you know, going into this in the world's largest independent film festival. I mean, I don't think that's ever going to go away.
No,
you know,
no.
Like Sundance and Ken or Ken. I can't even say it now.
I'm sorry. That's my fault.
It's an earworm.
Ken. They're never going to go away, and they're always going to. You're always going to take away something from it, whether it's a relationship with a new director or a producer or just getting to screen your film and knowing that people from all over the world had a chance to see it and did see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was actually, I think the year 2018, the year that we were there, there was some controversy going on between Netflix and the Cannes Film Festival because they submitted some films, but Cannes said that they couldn't play because they were already on the internet and they weren't playing at this amount of theaters in mm-hmm. France. So
I think it
there's
was stuff,
a big dispute. Yeah.
I think it was related to things like The Other Side of the Wind, the final Orson Welles film, because technically it had, I think that's why they had to give it at least 2 days in theaters or something ridiculous like that. Like
just barely meet the minimum.
Just to get around it. And that's what I fear is that these cultural institutions that I don't think they're going to go away. I think there's always going to be a Cannes Film Festival. I think there's always going to be a Sundance. I think there's going to be even more film festivals as we go along because it's easier and easier to set these things up. There's more of a thirst for it and a want for these sorts of things. But I'm afraid that these old institutions are rejecting something that is just going to become the norm, is kind of already the norm. How many movies and TV shows do we discover, watch, consume on Netflix, Hulu, what have you? Mm-hmm. And I'm finally getting access to stuff that I wouldn't have had access to before, especially through deals with Amazon and A24.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people could be discovering more like kind of capital I indie like Hereditary or Good Time through Amazon. Hulu's got a deal with Neon. People could be discovering more independent film there. I just don't want Cannes to be Luddites in that sense and have to stick to such a classical model, which is still rooted in a capitalist business structure. You know, theaters have a vested interest in Netflix not being as big because they want people to come to their theaters, spend money, do the whole thing.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't want to be like the old man on the lawn yelling it, like, get off my lawn, Netflix.
Because, get that streaming out of here.
Right, because like as subsequent generations of filmmakers start cropping up, you don't want to like turn those people away. You know, you don't want to make them feel like they're excluded.
I remember when I used to steal 16 millimeter prints of Star Wars off the back of a truck. That was my streaming.
I only paid $30 every time I went to the movie theaters. Now you kids are just fucking torrenting
$10 a month
Pan's Labyrinth in 4K.
But then again, I don't want places or companies like Netflix making, you know, Gene Siskel or Music Box like shutting down because
never. Yeah. Gene Siskel is huge. Yeah. It's a huge deal because I've just seen there. We've had the chance to speak to the assistant film programmer, and he was they're very adamant about having local film pretty regularly at the Gene Siskel, in addition to classics, you know, forgotten gems, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, when it comes to, let's move into, turning Hammersmith into a series. I want to jump back to that a second because you had this 48-hour movie, you know, and It did so well that you guys wanted to continue with it. What's it like switching from, we're going to do this one-off thing to, well, let's roll with it. Let's see where this idea goes.
Yeah. Well, it was actually a lot of fun. I mean, like, first of all, you know, shooting in Paris and, like, having all these people staying in this small apartment, which is, was just a lot of fun. But what was really cool about writing the story out was the first, the short film, the first episode worked really well as kind of just, like, there's all these kind of quick jokes, but the jokes are kind of also introducing these different characters. Mm-hmm. And then as we wrote the second episode and all this, and the full five episodes, we were able to find, like, this real arc where kind of, you know, this, like, mainly, you know, Bayou kind of changes. He kind of realizes how much of an idiot and an asshole he is thanks to, you know, the, all these other crew members kind of also developing in their own way. So it was a lot of fun kind of just to be able to keep playing with the characters and make it actually make them turn them into some real people, you know.
It's always a great hope when you're writing like a pilot that it's going to get to continue because you have so much more to say as, like, as each character develops and goes through their own storyline and finds out more about themselves through the series. You get to, you know, as an actor, like, it was just so fun to continue this character's story, and Malaya's story is quite interesting. So it's fun to get to play a lot more.
Yeah, I'm super excited for people to see Hannah's performance too, because you did an awesome job at some of these scenes that are going to be really cool.
I wanted to ask you, is Hammersmith available for people to watch now?
The
first episode, yes.
First episode, yeah.
The first episode, which is basically the short film, which is right now it's like 7 minutes. That's online because it's part of the 48-hour film project, and they have all their stuff available.
It's on Vimeo.com.
Yeah. But then we're going to re-edit that and add some stuff to it and make it, it's probably shorten it down to like 5 minutes. And then we're still shooting the web series now. Mm-hmm. And we're going to hopefully finish that in the next couple months. And then we'll just throw it to a bunch of more festivals this year.
Exciting.
And I want to ask, what is the crew looking like between the 48-hour film fest version of Hammersmith versus now? Are you guys as stressed out with, like, the time constraints? Obviously it'll be a little bit less, but, like, is Hannah the locations manager for this
I mean, pretty much. We did not expand that too much. I mean, whenever you're on a film set, there's always going to be time restraints because, you know, sitting in a room doing, like, 2 minutes of work for 8 or 10 hours is never, you know, people always want to, you know, get moving.
Right. And 8 hours of film is often like 2 pages of script.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is 2 minutes of film that you see. Yeah. You know.
But crew wise, what we've got, you know, we've kind of had to, you know, we've had a couple other, you know, sound people that we've added on. But yeah, I mean, the crew is still, you know, basically pretty skeleton. Yeah. It's pretty small. Because especially because, you know, we're not going to pay for a full crew to go to Paris.
Obviously. Right. Yeah. I mean, the Paris, you know? The Paris crew was like minimal bones, but we really made it. You know,
yeah,
we did
yeah.
good.
I luckily, there, yeah.
The, my, one of my favorite moments of all of Paris was just watching the Seine. Like, you guys were out right on the river, on the Seine River with the Notre Dame in the background.
Yeah.
And filming this incredible scene. It was just director Kyle, Justin, the cinematographer, and 2 actors. And that was it. The sound guy.
And no drone.
And no drone.
I want to make that very clear.
No drones.
Yeah. No, luckily luckily one of my oldest friends, like, from grade school is a sound guy. So he was, you know, getting him to come to Paris wasn't a problem. But no, the whole country of France is amazing when it comes to film, because you can go anywhere and just start filming and nobody will hassle you. Like, you could film on the street, you could film in front of, like, Notre Dame, you could film something with, like, a, you know, like a skeleton crew, and nobody will care. It's really, really cool.
And then Jean-Luc Godard will walk around in the background and be like,
he's like, "You're doing it wrong."
With a spit.
You call this cinema.
I was almost the director for Wayne's World.
I wanted to bring it back to Chicago because, you know, you guys are working here. You're part of this community. What is it about this city that seems to be really bringing in a lot of talent and giving people a lot of opportunities? A lot of folks we've talked to are seeing more and more steady work, whether it's through things like the Chicago Fire PDMD sort of stuff, right, whatever, or just people making movies here. People are coming in and saying, like, I want to make a movie here in Chicago with some money. I want to pay everybody. I want everybody to have a good experience. What is it about what's happening here?
Yeah, I don't know. Well, I mean, first of all, we have, like, I kind of think that on a larger scale, kind of like the Illinois started giving some tax credits to films.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then, like, Chicago Studio City and CineSpace, you know, made these huge places where it was actually able for studios to come in and do a bunch of stuff. But yeah, I mean, just as far as, I think just Chicago has a bunch of artists in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, there's a bunch of cool
hipsters.
It's
the biggest city in the Midwest. And just,
yeah.
And it's a right smack dab in the middle of the country, and I think it's just, it's super inspiring. It's got a pulse. Chicago has a pulse, like, that's flowing through the city that is unlike New York and unlike LA. For me, I've experienced a little bit of LA and a bit of New York, and I've never found such a community vibe as I have here in Chicago.
And it's very much an actor's city. I mean,
yes,
this is a place where
one of the most raw, like, talented theater cities in the country.
Absolutely. So as an actor, would you say that you find a great amount of satisfaction knowing that you can do film, or you can be like, you know what, fuck it, I'll try out for Steppenwolf, I'll try out for Goodman, see what's happening?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's the reason why I stayed here instead of going to LA or New York. LA was, you know, it still is, like, in the back of my mind, like, maybe my next move, my next step. But in terms of just being close to what I know, and, like, Michigan has just been such a part of my home. I'm from Michigan, so I love being on the water and also being in a big city and having kind of really, like, I'm up to my knees in, like, all of these different communities and all these different artist circles and underground spaces, and people can create whatever. You can create an indie film that goes to Cannes on your iPhone now. So that's also proved, you know, exceptional, and people can really just get together with a group of five friends and really write it out and write something, and it can go very far.
Yeah, I think like Second City and IO are another big plus. I mean, on top of all of the theater, is the fact that this is like a hub where, like, if you want to be in comedy, you have to at some point come to Chicago.
You got to do Chicago for at least a few years and learn that trade.
So there's just so much, like, good sketch, like, even if they're just small sketches that people just shoot together, like, there's so much funny stuff being made in Chicago. But yeah, there's just a lot going on.
And there's a little bit less equity, I think, being placed in, you know, LA, in New York, in the traditional sense, because you don't really need the huge studios anymore to get noticed, right? I mean, with the internet and everything else, I mean, everybody has a platform now. I mean, it's just dog-eat-dog for most views, right?
Yeah.
I'm curious about when you guys are setting out to create content, do you find that living in the city, like, everything from the weather to the people to just... Because there's definitely a vibe in Chicago that's way different than LA in New York, right? Do you guys find the culture of Chicago kind of bleeding into, Hannah, for you, like, your performances, and for you, Kyle, the stuff that you end up making?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
there's a style. There's a Chicago mode.
There's, like, a grit, you know? There's,
like,
kind of, like, an earthiness to Chicago people. Like, I don't know. I've heard that the Midwestern state of mind, right? It's, like, down to earth. You kind of know who you are. At least you're figuring it out with gusto. And you're, like, it's a scrappiness. It's a resourcefulness. And creates kind of a raw vulnerability that people really attract to when you're on screen or when you're on stage.
It's also the friendliness, you know, like, kind of the cliche that, you know, the Midwesterns are so friendly and you
open
know, compared to a New Yorker or whatever. But I think that definitely has to do with it, because, like, there's all these Facebook groups and stuff, like Chicago production Facebook groups, and you can just go on and just say, like, hey, like, I need a sound person tomorrow, you know, and a bunch of people will jump up and they'll be, you know, totally, like, reasonable with, like, their rates and all that stuff.
And they'll be good. They'll be
yeah,
really
yeah,
good.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Right, yeah.
That's,
yeah.
That's the best part, is that you've got an influx of super talented people who really just, they're not looking for, $1 million. Yeah. They want to work. And that's what I've noticed with Hammersmith, and also as something we'll talk about, Eat Your Heart Out, something coming up in the near future from you, Kyle, is that there is a real earnestness, and there's a real focus on the craft of what people are doing. And everyone I've talked to, whether they're in front of the camera, behind it, doing lighting, doing sound, I really like the can-do, get-down-to-it attitude of making art here, and saying, like, I don't really care all that much if people in LA see it or if people in New York see it. I care if my friends and the communities that I'm a part of see it, and maybe it'll change them or give them something to think about over time. Yeah. It's a spectacular city. It's
a lovely place.
Really. Lovely place. My kind of
so
town.
So much thanks to the Palooza family.
The Palooza.
That these things should work out.
I'm not unconvinced that there isn't a Palooza family.
Are they lizards? We don't know. Find out tonight.
Find out tonight. More at 11. Let's talk about what's coming up next for you guys. Kyle, I mentioned Eat Your Heart Out, which you were so kind to let us take a look at and watch.
Yeah.
What an interesting premise. I have to say, watching this movie, I don't want to give away too much because I think it's something that you got to see. But
this, by the way, was written and directed by Abby Pierce. And yes. I believe, Kyle, you were the editor and assistant director?
Yeah, I assistant directed it, and I edited it with Abby, and then was a producer as well. But it was also written by Abby Pierce and Julie Lederer, who's a stage wright.
Okay.
Playwright. Stage wright.
So, Abby Pierce. Stage wright.
Con.
Abby Pierce, come on the show.
Yeah.
Let's talk.
Yeah, I'm sure she would love to.
Eat Your Heart Out, which you edited, and you were so, you and Abby were so kind to share with us.
Super.
Just watching it, there's a lot of focus on the heart.
Yep.
In a very literal sense, a lot of the idea of pumping blood,
perhaps magical realism,
a little magical
term
realism.
could be thrown in there.
That's so funny that you say that, because Abby is obsessed with magical realism.
She's a real Gabriel Garcia Marquez fan.
It's so fun. I mean, Matt, I did a film that was all based around magical realism, and it's so fun.
It is cool. It really made watching it. It made me really like feel the thing, especially because I have a little bit of not a phobia, but just kind of like a weird thing about when I think about the concept of a heart pumping blood through a body. It really freaks me out, and I'm just like, ooh,
of Doom.
It'd be weird if you were like, oh yeah, that's normal.
Yeah. Yeah,
maybe that
was what Abby was going for. I hope so. I hope I'm reading that right. But it was weird to be watching this work, this piece, and like kind of scrunched up in my chair, kind of like, ooh, like very conscious of it. But it's beautiful and fantastic editing, by the way.
Thank you very much.
Really appreciate it. So that's something coming down the line for you too.
Yeah, that'll be premiering at a fest at some point this year.
Mm. He's raising his eyebrows.
TBA. Yeah. Well, it's good to know that everybody's got stuff coming down the pipeline, because these things do take time. I think sometimes folks don't always realize that, like, once you make the movie, it's not just out.
Yeah.
Like, you have to, there's the whole submission process and maybe, you know, getting it online, getting on Netflix or whatever.
And each submission costs money.
Yes.
You have to fund it. And you have to,
It's a very big process.
You have to choose your premieres very wisely, too, and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I'm in pre-pro right now for a short film as well. So that's, it's fun, but it's like, it's again, it tells you the process of it, right? It's just getting the idea, then writing it, then getting your crew, then getting your location, getting all of the actors together, and then setting it up and figuring it out. Yeah.
I mean, are you able to tell us a little bit about
it? It's it's directed and written by Ethan Talley. It's called Room with Cages. It's going to be probably a 20-minute, maybe less than 20-minute short film about a veterinarian and a woman coming in with a sick dog. And they have this kind of spark in their relationship that they form with each other. And it's sort of a symbol for loss and rebirth and coming into new experiences when doors get shut or when people leave from your life and or when death happens unexpectedly.
Oh man,
it sounds heartbreaking and heart-making.
There you go.
And how far into that process are you, Hannah?
We are securing the location. We'll probably be shooting it in February.
Okay.
And we're casting the co-star right now.
Oh. Beautiful. Yeah. Well, the machine keeps going. The people are moving. Gotta. They're hustling. They're getting out there because that's what you do in Chicago. You get down to the grind. Yeah, the grind is on. The hustle is on. And very excited to be seeing it. You know, I'm so glad to be having, you know, filmmakers and American actors. I'm very giddy.
I know. We haven't, that's what we were saying before this. We haven't had filmmakers or actors on that actually like show us their stuff, you know.
So, oh, wow.
Well, you know, in a bit. I mean,
yeah, it's
we
been a little
do
while.
Have that, but it's been a bit. So yeah. It's such a pleasure to have it all at once. You know?
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much. If I'm not mistaken,
you guys are going to be going to shoot another episode or part of an
tomorrow.
Episode of Hammersmith.
Yeah, we're literally gonna go rehearse right after this.
Woo!
And then we're shooting some fun scenes tomorrow.
Exciting stuff. Well, thank you so much, Hannah Copen, and also
Kyle Leland.
Thank you.
Both here in the No Coast studio.
Yes.
That's what's
in beautiful 303 East Upper Wecker. About 400 feet in the air, would you say?
I'd say.
Yeah.
I get it. Get the tape measure.
Yeah.
Bring the tape measure. We'll figure it out. Thank you guys both again for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks
absolutely.
For having us.
Thank you.
All right. So that's been No Coast Cinema here on WGM Plus.
I'm sorry. I just completely derailed your conclusion.
You know what? We had a really nice show. We had a really good conversation with two beautifully talented people, and this is how you end it? On a fucking Bare Naked Ladies reference?
I think you forgot how horrible the introduction to this episode went as well, so it's kind of a beautiful, untidy knot on both sides. Fuck you, Tom.
Connor, it's been a long time since I've said this, but you're my best friend, but I also fucking hate you.
I'm glad we're bringing that back. Because
it's good. Well, people have forgotten. just a couple of things to keep on the lookout for is we are going to be doing an introduction and Q&A with Michael
Glover Smith
over at the Gene Siskel. It's going to be for Rendezvous in Chicago.
Yep.
It's got, I believe it's like a 4 or 5 night stint over at the...
But we are doing the premiere. We're introducing and hosting the Q&A for the premiere, the Chicago premiere of Rendezvous in Chicago, which, if I'm not mistaken, Tom, was like one of your favorite movies of last year.
It really was. It had what I referred to as my favorite film moment of 2018, beating out every major motion picture I saw in the theater. I have to say that every time I talk about Rendezvous in Chicago, because I want people to see it. I really want people to enjoy what's happening there. So that's coming on the pipeline. Also, we're going to be talking to our old friend, Nick Alonzo.
Yes.
It's been a while. He's got something new in the pipe, and we're really excited to talk to him. He's, you know, he did Chicago. He did
The Art of Sitting Quietly and Doing Nothing.
Which last time when we had him on, we had a great conversation about that. So please jump on back to our conversations with Nick and refamiliarize yourself with him.
Is it Decaf Don? Nice. Fuck yeah. Michael Glover Smith's in that. And so is Dustin Puehler.
One of those things. We're seeing the connections here. It's as we were talking about the Chicago film community. But nonetheless, you've been listening to No Coast Cinema here on WGM Plus. We are your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago. I am Tom Hush.
And I'm Connor Cornelius.
And we will see you all next time.